March 4th, 1910. Emergency workers toil close to midnight clearing 20 feet of snow off buried railroad tracks. They don't know that in just a few minutes, they'll be part of a disaster that changed the course of railway history. Rogers Pass in British Columbia's Selkirk Mountains is no stranger to avalanches, especially in the spring. The men know this. They work in constant fear of avalanches. A steam-powered snowblower bellows into the black night as it cuts through the wall of snow. The noise is so loud, the workers don't hear the rumble from the slopes up above. A wall of ice and snow has slipped from the mountaintop. It hurtles towards the crew, moving faster than a steam train. Just a handful of the 63 men are aware of the cold death racing towards them.
I'm Les Stroud. I've survived some of the deadliest environments on Earth, but there are some things that even I might not walk away from. This is Deadly Disasters.
Today, the Rogers Pass Avalanche. In 1871, Canada is a young nation, just 4 years old and still growing. British Columbia agrees to join the nascent Confederation, but with one big condition. The distance between it and the rest of the country would have to be addressed, and Canada has the industrial power to make it happen. Pat Dunn of the Mount Revelstoke and Glacier National Parks explains.
And at that time, British Columbia was only going to enter Confederation if a railway was completed right from coast to coast. So the construction proceeded. It started in the west and it started in the east and slowly inched its way across the continent to meet basically near the Selkirk Mountains.
On November 7, 1885, that promise is fulfilled. The final spike, the last of 30 million, is driven in. The Canadian Pacific Railway is complete. 14 years of sweat, struggle, and death is finally over. One person died for every mile of track laid between Calgary and Vancouver. It's fitting that construction ends in the treacherous Selkirk Mountains, more than 1,000 feet high, home of Rogers Pass. Barbara Gervin, a historian at the Revelstoke Railway Museum, knows how dangerous that area is.
Railway construction through the Rogers Pass was some of the most difficult construction. The terrain was a big part of it, the steep hills and the deep valleys and the snowfall. Rogers Pass receives an average of 35 to 50 feet of snow in a winter, and of course this impeded their efforts to build.
The snow is more than just an obstacle to be removed. It's death from above, particularly in the spring.
If it thawed and froze and had rain on top of that, that would create a lot more hazard. And the men were aware of this. They worked in fear of avalanches.
David Skunsberg is the manager of Parks Canada's Avalanche Control Section in Revelstoke. An avalanche expert, he explains one of the precautions taken at the time.
At the turn of the century, they had no avalanche control as such. They had to keep this main line open, and to do that, they built snow sheds. That was their only defense against avalanches, was to build snow sheds.
The sheds are a roof over the rails, made from wooden planks and supported by timber posts. A train runs safely underneath one, regardless of the weather. Barbara Gervin elaborates.
If an avalanche comes down over top of it, it would just slide right over top and not interrupt train flow.
Even Even so, snow sheds don't cover the tracks all the way through the mountains. They only provide a small amount of protection. Pat Dunn explains that the end of construction didn't mean the end of danger.
Right from the very first week of construction in Rogers Pass, when two men were killed, right through the whole history of the railway presence in Rogers Pass, avalanches were frequent and deaths were frequent.
24 years into the railway's use, Rogers Pass remains an ominous presence on the line, particularly the winter of 1910. The storms have been severe, leaving a worrying amount of snow in the Selkirk Mountains. By the end of February, warmer temperatures arrive, making the pass even more volatile. If the snow melts and refreezes, a slick crust can form on top. When the temperature drops and it snows, the new snowfall sits on an icy surface ready to slide off. David Skjonsberg discusses the temperature in Rogers Pass late that winter.
The weather had warmed up and rain had been falling in the area. And these are, as we know today, definite warning signs of avalanche potential. This is a classic situation for avalanche events to occur.
On March 4th, 1910, the railway's Pacific Express, filled with passengers, steams into the unstable pass. A blizzard had been raging all day. The weather had cleared enough for the engineer to survey the landscape. High up in the mountains, a wall of snow gives way. The engineer spots the avalanche. He opens the throttle. The train is now in a life and death race. The engineer pushes on as a relentless barrage of ice and snow tumbles towards the train and its passengers. The avalanche crashes into the tracks, less than 100 meters behind the train. The train pulls into a nearby station. Relieved passengers wait out the storm. But nature is just getting started. Another major snowslide strikes nearby, at Mount Cheops, close to the summit of Rogers Pass. The main line is buried under nearly 20 feet of snow. Catherine English, a historian with the Revelstoke Museum and Archives, explains the situation.
It was severe enough that it closed down the track. There was, at that point, apparently a passenger train stranded east of the first slide. And it was just general company policy, whenever there was a slide, to clear it as soon as possible.
Canadian Pacific Railway roadmaster John Anderson leads the clearance team. They've been busy. Harsh winter storms have submerged the rails in snow. Anderson's granddaughter, Julie Lawson, relays the events of that night.
On this particular occasion, he'd been working with his crew all day long, and then another slide came down at the summit of Rogers Pass and buried the track some 20 feet deep. So he called out the crew and off they went to clear this particular slide.
John Anderson arrives at dusk with a clearing crew of 63 men, including his younger brother, Charles. Another member of the crew, Richard Buckley, is on one of his last shifts before an important break. He plans to reconcile with his wife after a 15-year separation. But Buckley has a job to do first. He's in charge of the huge rotary plow, a massive early 20th century steam-powered snowblower on rails. It looks like a locomotive engine with a turbine in the front. Barbara Gervin tells how the machine operates.
The rotary plow was powered by a locomotive boiler. It would have had a crew of an engineer and a fireman on it. The boiler powered the big rotary blade at the front and it rotated, and there would have been a blower where the snow escaped as the plow was cutting through the snow.
Engineer William Phillips drives the locomotive pushing the plow. Fireman Bill Lachance loads coal into the furnace. He gives a first-hand account from an interview in 1966.
We went up there and we bucked right into the snow slide, you know. But it was a messy place because it was full of timber. The slide that come down brought timber and everything with it. Everything cleaned the hill right off, you know. It must have run for over a mile down the hill.
The rotary snowplow cuts a hole 18 feet deep in the wall of snow, but progress is painfully slow. The crew isn't just dealing with snow. They have to worry about the debris, too. David Skonsberg talks about these hazards.
They were having trouble using the rotary plow, which every time it would encounter a tree would break down. So the only option they had was to have a crew of shovelers in the cut, and they could feed snow into the rotary plow, and it could be blown out that way.
The price of caution is time. The exhausted crew heaves snow into the plow long into the evening. They make progress, but slowly. At 11:30 p.m., John Anderson leaves the crew for a short trek to the watchman's shack 450 meters away. Julie Lawson explains the reason for the trip.
As a roadmaster, he had to report every couple of hours to let the dispatcher know how soon the tracks would be cleared. And they'd been working so hard that he'd forgotten to phone in his report.
John passes his younger brother, Charles, working hard until the task is done. Another crew member, Fritz Wellander, is showing uncommon dedication. He came back to work that morning, although he would have been excused for passing on this assignment. Julie Lawson explains.
We'd just been married just a few days before, and he and his bride had gone on a honeymoon, and he'd come back, and instead of taking an extra day off, he'd gone out to join the crew.
Noise on the worksite is overwhelming for anyone working in the trench. Duncan McCrae, a young carpenter, is standing away from the action, though. He hears a rumble, far away at first, but getting closer. With the noise of the steam from the rotary and the wildness of the storm, he's unsure of what to make of it all. Then he hears trees cracking above and immediately knows the worst is yet to come. Workmen are fully engaged in their task, unaware of the mass of snow and ice bulldozing the heavy forest on the lower slopes. Broken timbers become part of the advancing wall of death. David Skonsberg explains.
Avalanches on average travel in the area of, say, 70 to 100 kilometers an hour. In extreme cases, they've been observed to travel at speeds in excess of 300 kilometers an hour.
In the light of day, with someone watching the slope, the crew may have had a chance to run. But as Julie Lawson explains, in the pitch black, close to midnight, working beside the bellowing plow, the men don't notice the avalanche until it hits them with a crushing force.
It must have been just instant. They just never would have had a chance to take a breath.
If you have ever wanted to make your home feel safer, there's no better time than now. This week, our friends at Simply Safe are giving Deadly Disasters listeners 40% off
their award-winning home security. Simply Safe has everything you need to make your home safe. Indoor and outdoor cameras, comprehensive sensors, all monitored around the clock by trained professionals who send help the instant you need it. Simply Safe was even named Best Home Security System of 2021 by U.S. News and World Report. You can customize a system for your home easily online in minutes and even get free custom recommendations from Simply Safe. These are Simply Safe's biggest discounts of the year. You can get a complete home security system starting at just over $100. There are no long-term contracts or commitments. It's a really easy way to start feeling a bit more peace of mind. So take advantage of Simply Safe's holiday sale and get 40% off your new home security system by visiting simplysafe.com/deadly. Again, that's simplysafe.com/deadly for 40% off your entire system. What are you waiting for? This offer ends soon.
March 4th, 1910. In Rogers Pass, British Columbia, a Canadian Pacific Railway crew has been toiling until near midnight to clear a 20-foot wall of snow off the railroad tracks. They're still battling the barrier when the mountain sends a torrent of ice, snow, and timber toward them. Duncan McCrae, who's working outside the trench, hears it coming, but just barely. He tries to run, but he's struggling in the deep snow. McCrae doesn't get far. A blast of wind scoops McCrae up and hurls him into Snowshed 17. David Skjonsberg explains the phenomenon known as an air blast.
The wind blast associated with avalanches is in fact quite rare. However, in very large events, you do get an air turbulence wave ahead of the avalanche, and the destructive power of this air blast is quite significant.
In the cab of the locomotive, fireman Bill Lachance leans in to stoke the furnace. He jumps back when flames suddenly shoot out of the firebox. Bill Lachance recalls the impact in an interview in 1966.
Of course, it was only a fraction of a second the snow come in through across the gangway. It hit me, and it picked me up just as this flame come out of the firebox. Pulled me out twice my length, I guess, the way it fell, and then it had just doubled me all up and rolled me like that. And I was trying to keep rolled up in a ball to go with the snow. I don't get one breath because the snow has got packed right tight to my face. And then this pressure come on and things kind of stop.
Despite the horrible impact, Lachance can still move, as historian Catherine English explains.
He actually was able to push himself out from the snow and get his head above the snow. He tried to use his feet to push himself up, and then at that point realized that there was something very wrong with one of his legs.
I just touched the toe of that foot to the snow, the right foot, and it just turned, and that knee went right bump down into the snow sideways. And, well, that was that. It must have been all happened pretty fast, because after I got out, I couldn't hear the engine. The engine should have been blowing a lot of steam, but there was no sound there. Everything was just dead, that's all. Everything was just dead.
The deep trench the crew dug through the evening is gone, replaced by a plain of snow and wood. Roadmaster John Anderson returns to the scene after calling in a progress report. Pat Dunn describes the scene he walks into.
He went back to the watchman's cabin to make the call to town, and left behind him there were the lights of the engine, the headlight of the engine, and the headlamps and lanterns of the men working. Went and made his call and said, "We're moving right along," and then went back and the lights were all gone. No glow from the fireman's box, no headlamp for the rotary.
Anderson's granddaughter, Julie Lawson, has trouble even comprehending the scene.
I just can't begin to imagine what that would have felt like to get back there and have the quiet, like no sounds of men's voices, no sound of any kind of work being done, and the darkness, and knowing what had happened.
Anderson finds the 100-ton rotary plow sitting on top of Snowshed 17. The massive piece of equipment is tossed aside like a child's toy.
And he heard a voice answering very faintly, "Over here." And so he trudged through the snow with his lantern, and it was up higher than his waist, and he found Bill LaChance.
Pat Dunn describes the encounter.
"Bill, he saw him coming up with his lantern and said, 'What happened? Where is everybody? What happened?' And Johnny Anderson says to him, 'Oh, Bill, they're all gone. They're just gone. They're all gone.'"
But Anderson is wrong. They aren't all gone. Duncan McCrae was hurled into Snowshed 17 by a wall of air, but he staggers out, somehow still alive. John Anderson approaches the kitchen car. It's been overturned by the force of the snow. Anderson expects the worst. Instead, he finds the camp cook shaken, but uninjured. Together, they move Bill LaChance to safety. Then Anderson calls Revelstoke for help. Catherine English describes the reaction in town.
As soon as the word was received in Revelstoke, they rang the fire bell, and they rang as many engines as they could at the station just to alert the town that there was an emergency and to call people out to respond to it.
The town was ready for a disaster like this, as Julie Lawson explains.
The whole town knew what was going on, so people would, you know, grab blankets and shovels and went to the station. They always had a train ready with a steam up, just in case.
The rescue workers are ready for an emergency, but nothing could prepare them for what they see: complete devastation. More than 400 feet of snow has crushed the worksite. Shed 17 has been torn away, its heavy timber snapped like matchsticks. What awaits them under the snow is even worse. In the early morning hours of March 5th, 1910, rescue workers from the town of Revelstoke, British Columbia, arrive at Rogers Pass. They're responding to an emergency call. More than 60 men with shovels and a huge steam-powered rotary plow pushed by a locomotive had been clearing walls of snow off the railway when an avalanche hit. In the light of dawn, the rescuers find the locomotive on its side, buried under a bank of snow. Pinned beneath it is the broken body of engineer William Phillips. John Anderson makes a discovery of his own. His granddaughter, Julie Lawson, explains.
He saw a glove sticking out of the snow, and there was a hand inside the glove, and he then cleared away the snow, and it was the conductor, I believe his name was Buckley, and he got him out of the snow, but he was very badly injured. I think he was unconscious at the time, and I think he died an hour or so later.
The trench cleared by the plow and shoveling crew is covered by almost 30 feet of snow. Historian Catherine English describes the search for bodies.
Of course, they couldn't use the rotary to clear this. It was all done with shovels. It had to be very slow. At that point, there was no thought of any possibility of survivors.
As avalanche expert David Skjonsberg explains, the search for survivors was hopeless before it had even begun.
With the tools they had available at that time, it would have been almost physically impossible to remove somebody from that avalanche deposit in half an hour. That's about what you have available before you suffocate, is around half an hour.
As the bodies are uncovered, it's obvious just how quickly the avalanche struck.
Many, many people were found exactly in the spot that they were when the avalanche hit.
John Anderson's granddaughter, Julie Lawson, recounts the grisly scene.
There was a group of three foremen who were standing up when they were dug out of the snow as if they had just been in the middle of having a chat, and one of them was still holding his pipe. And another fellow was found with his fingers clutched around papers as if he was about to roll a cigarette.
Over the next few days, 58 bodies are recovered. John Anderson's brother Charles is one of them. So is Fritz Wellender, married only a few days earlier. The coroner's inquest convenes. What could have led to the loss of life in the Rogers Pass avalanche? The first jury fails to agree on a verdict. The second takes less than an hour to make its decision. Catherine English explains their findings.
The second jury agreed that it was purely accidental, it was an act of God. There was no criminal neglect or no liability on the part of the Canadian Pacific Railway, and that their only recommendation was that perhaps crews shouldn't be working during severe storms at night.
The tragedy is more than John Anderson can take. 5 days after the disaster, he resigns. His granddaughter, Julie Lawson, explains.
He gave up a promotion too, I believe. He took a demotion, a lower rate of pay, because he just didn't want to be in that situation again.
Anderson's daughter, Mabel, reveals the effect the loss had on her father.
But I think my dad must have been traumatized because he'd lost his young brother. He would feel terrible. He would wonder why he was safe. He liked all the men, and every man would be important to him. It would hurt him terribly.
Bill LaChance escapes with two broken legs and a host of cuts and bruises. He recovers, then returns to the Mountain Railroad. But his troubles are not all behind him, as historian Barbara Gervin explains.
He had two more train wrecks where his train ended up in the river as a result of rock slides, and at that point decided that possibly railroading was not for him and took a job as a barber, actually, and led a less exciting life after that.
The railway also decides they need less excitement. Rogers Pass is too dangerous for a rail line.
The number of fatalities was a contributing factor in Canadian Pacific Railway's decision to go underground and build a diversion tunnel through the Rogers Pass, this tunnel being the Connaught Tunnel. It was 5 miles long and went directly under Mount MacDonald and eliminated the need to go up and over the Rogers Pass.
The Canadian Pacific Railway is more than just transportation. It's a symbol of human achievement. But as Pat Denn explains, nature does not submit easily. Its will is relentless.
I think basically they just conceded defeat. They tried everything that they could think of, and really the 1910 disaster was just too much, and it was time for the railway just to leave Rogers Pass and abandon that danger forever.
Today, the best avalanche detection system in the world monitors Rogers Pass. It uses technology which detects low-frequency sounds to hear avalanches early, giving rescue crews a head start that can save lives. Prevention is also a priority. For 60 years, the Canadian military has fired howitzer shells into the mountains to knock snow off the slopes after a big storm. Rogers Pass may no longer be used by the railway, but the lives lost there have never been forgotten.
Rogers Pass is a National Historic Site today, commemorating the transportation route in the early railroad years. There's a little interpretive sign that's all that marks the place where these 58 men died in the 1910 slide. And people are quite moved by that such a disaster happened here so long ago, and so many people that gave their lives in order to keep transportation moving across Canada was what it came down to.
The disaster changed the course of the railway, and at least in this stretch of the Canadian wilderness, challenged the belief that humanity's ambition is beyond the reach of nature's power. This episode of Deadly Disasters was produced by Ajit Parkal and Miklas Perlis for Storios. Adapted for audio by Craig Colby. And sound designed and mixed by Brian Eimer at Images and Sound. This podcast is adapted from the television series Disasters of the Century. Our executive producer is Ron Getz, and our supervising producer is Robert Lachman. Deadly Disasters is a production of Partners in Motion. I'm Les Stroud.